Welcome to This Week, to the Bible Project Podcast. Today on the show, we are doing a mid-series question and response episode. We're talking about the character of God in this series, and with me is Tim and Carissa. Hi.
Hey, John.
Hey there. Here we are.
Here we are.
Yep.
So we have some questions from people following along with the Character of God series, walking through these attributes that God declares of himself in a famous story in Exodus 34. So if you've been following along, awesome. If you haven't, you can start from the beginning or just jump in now with these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's get to it.
Let us.
The first question is from Nancy in Michigan.
Hi, I'm Nancy from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thank you for this excellent series. Here's my question. My son grew up in the church but has been questioning his faith. At times he sees God as being contradictory and appears to be emotionally abusive at times. In one of your podcasts, you mentioned that Jesus is the full orb portrait of God. If people don't see this, they are either misunderstanding God or Jesus or both. What exactly would you say people are misunderstanding about the God of the Old Testament and Jesus of the New Testament? Thanks.
Great question.
Yeah, I feel like this is a question that a lot of people have and a lot of people resonate with.
Yep. Yeah. I have found this. I think we all have talked about this, all three of us at some point, that it's actually a more regular experience that I found in pastoral ministry when people are coming to own their faith. Or they're just exploring it to try and take it more seriously, and they just read the actual Bible as opposed to rely on the versions of the stories that they were given through teaching or something. There's a whole phase, usually, of the Bible creating all these problems for people. Actually, John, you lived there for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very common issue. The portrait of God is complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And difficult to process. And I just thought you were doing a Character of God series, and I think Nancy and her son's experience probably represent where a lot of us have been or are in this moment.
It's especially hard when you are reading, say, the Psalms, and you just want some real feel-good, like, worshipful, contemplative things, and the psalmists are talking about a really retaliatory or angry God that does, at times, strike you as, is this abusive? Is this gone too far? Mm. And when you kind of pull those out and you're confronted with those, that's a total, I've experienced that same feeling.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. She uses the word, or her son, I guess, emotionally abusive at times. And it seems like that topic of the violence of God or violent depictions of God in the Old Testament especially is really hard to deal with. And I guess for me, when I think about questions like this for myself or for other people, it seems really important to acknowledge that there's space to ask those questions and there's space within even the Christian tradition to not know the answers to those things, like to just recognize that a lot of people think differently about these issues. Like some people read the Old Testament and think this is an ancient document that, you know, is written by ancient authors who were accommodating, or God was accommodating their culture and their style of communication, or God was actually accommodating in how he acted within history, or there are just a lot of different ways that we can read and interpret scripture. And I guess it's helpful for me to recognize that that there's space within the Christian tradition to ask these kind of questions and think about how we interpret.
Yeah, that's well said on both of those points. So, however, you know, there are ways to get an angle to make some forward movement in our understanding. This is actually kind of a surprising perspective that I find keeps helping me process this. And it has to do with the composite mosaic character of the Bible. So, you know, these texts emerge from, if you take the Hebrew Bible, but then add the New Testament on, we're talking about over a millennium-long process of the collection and shaping of these texts. And so the biblical texts incorporate stories and poems and laws and all kinds of stuff from all these periods of Israelite history and experience. But they have been brought, organized together with patterns and a message and so on. And so that's what our whole How to Read the Bible series is about. But it does create a challenge, because when I encounter, like, you, John, or Carissa, and we work together and we see each other on a regular basis. And pretty much, you know, your behavior is consistent from day to day. And you start to build up a portrait over time of like, oh, here's how Chris is. This is her character that I infer from your behavior. And then let's say you get to know somebody long enough and there'll be something extreme that happens. And then there'll be some new aspect of their character. And like, whoa, wow, that's, I didn't see that. And so there is something kind of analogous like that to the Bible, but it's actually more complex because it wasn't all written at one go. Mm-hmm. And so the way God behaves in one story and then the way God behaves in another story, he'll like judge a whole city and destroy it, but then he'll forgive a murderer like Cain. And you're just like, what? What's the deal? And so what we have to do, and what Christians have struggled to do, is in adopting the Hebrew scriptures, putting them alongside the stories of Jesus, the writings of the apostles, we have this huge project of synthesis that lay before us of how to create a mosaic portrait of God's character out of all of these pieces from different times and places. And I think that's essentially the challenge, is finding the continuity. And so what we're emphasizing in this series is that the Yahweh of the Hebrew Bible is actually a lot more generous, gracious, and compassionate than most people tend to think. What we're not focusing on, but which is true, is that Jesus is actually a lot more aggressive and intense and judgmental than people often make him out to be. He certainly didn't get crucified for telling people to love your neighbor. He got crucified for critiquing publicly the religious and political authorities of his day. And he was very intense with them and said they were going to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is we also need to learn how to augment this. Old Testament is the angry God. New Testament is the loving Jesus. Those caricatures don't do justice to either. So those are two factors that have been helpful for me as I go in to think about individual texts.
I think how we're doing these word studies really brings that out too, because in each one, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in hesed and faithfulness, we're talking about those words through the whole Hebrew Bible and then how those things come to fulfillment in Jesus. So yes. I think this word study series in particular really highlights the character of God in the Old Testament and the character of Jesus in a way that shows continuity.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So I do think part of what it means to be a Christian is to read the Old and New Testaments together as a unity, but that doesn't mean they're uniform in all their depictions of God. That's what I was talking about a few minutes ago. They're a mosaic that come from a lot of different places and times. And so the goal is to create an overall synthesis and read each individual story in light of that larger synthesis that really culminates in Jesus. And so it's tricky. It's learning to let that bigger picture inform how I read individual stories where God might behave in ways that don't seem to fit with Jesus. But then what I find is over time, there are fewer and fewer of those stories. There are still some, for me at least, stories about what God does that doesn't, they're harder to fit.
When you read the Psalms, and you come across those intense, I mean, even just Psalm 1, let's say. Mm. It's really beautiful. But there's a couple things in there about...
about the wicked not standing in the judgment.
Maybe I'm thinking Psalm 2 even.
Terrifying the kings in his anger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you could put yourself back in a place where your enemies surrounding you are a real life and death threat.
Yeah.
And you can have some more empathy for that being kind of this, oh, cool. That's a refreshing thing to hear almost.
Yes, yeah.
But from a modern perspective, it just comes across as just...
Yeah, but it depends on whose modern perspective, you know? If my social location is among an ethnic group that hasn't got to cash in on the benefits of the modern world, but usually these are people groups on whose backs the modern world was built through slavery or some kind of exploitation, then the portrait of God as the vindicator of the oppressed, like what I'm saying is it's not just an ancient idea that God is the vindicator of the oppressed and that he deals harshly with violent, oppressive nations and rulers. That is still good news and a real hope to a lot of people right now today in the city that I'm living in. You know, so I think there, for example, you know, Psalm 137, we sit by the rivers of Babylon and weep.
Yeah, right.
It begins with the Babylonian oppressors demanding that their new slaves sing them their traditional folk songs, right? They demand the Israelites are singing them the praise songs that used to be sung in the temple that the Babylonians destroyed. And what it ends with is calling a curse down on Babylon and Edom that their children be dashed on the rocks.
Yeah. It's brutal.
It is. But it's also it's an honest prayer coming from people whose babies were just dashed on the rocks by their oppressors. So I think what you just said earlier about the violence in the Bible, the violence of God in the Bible, also applies to this. There's space within the biblical tradition itself for God's people to cry out. And none of these poets actually did these things to other people's babies. They're just saying what they feel and what they wish God would do. And to me, it's amazing that the Bible is endorsing that we bring all of our emotional reactions before him and pour them out before him in prayer. So that's a good example where something that might to some people seem really off-putting, but I think if you really begin to ponder who's writing this in the Bible and why, usually it takes me back to school and I have to eat some humble pie.
Well, so Nancy's specific question was, what do you say to people who misunderstand the God of the Old Testament or Jesus in the New Testament? And what I heard you say, Tim, was that a surprising thing for most people is that the God of the Old Testament is much more gracious and compassionate than he gets street cred for.
Yeah.
And Jesus in the Gospels could come across as a little more cantankerous and...
Yeah. Yeah, intense,
even judgmental than he has street cred for.
Yeah, and sorry, judgmental not with its, that kind of has a negative connotation in English, but judgmental in terms of critiquing and casting and giving judgment on oppressive rulers of his day.
He got angry at the oppressive rulers, especially the religious oppressors.
That's right. Yeah. So these are aspects about the God of the Old Testament and of Jesus that usually aren't being considered when people create a divide between the depiction of God in the Old and New Testament.
What's one good practical next step for someone who really is hung up with their experience with the God of the Bible as being emotionally abusive?
Yeah.
If they have some scars, and it might be from the way people have used Scripture, it might be from their experience with Scripture.
Yeah.
What would you say, just what's one good thing to do?
Such a good question.
Yeah, it is. You know, something that I recommended as a pastor for lots of people, especially when people were new to the Bible, is just hang out in the Gospels and just read the Bible for a while as if all you have is the four Gospels. And after long, you'll realize that you need the whole Bible to understand the Jesus portrayed in these four stories. But Jesus's character, even with his intensity, the amazing character that's has been compelling to people all over the planet for 2,000 years just shines and allows, I think, forces you to go back into the first three quarters of your Bible then and say, if this whole section of the Bible is leading up to the person that I've been thinking and reading a lot about in the four gospel accounts, then it just changes. It just changes how you read the Old Testament. And then find some good teachers, books, videos, or resources to help guide you through the Old Testament. Because a big part of it, too, is the culture gap between us and the world of the Hebrew Bible, where the depictions of God make a lot more sense in light of the cultural context of ancient
Israel.
Yeah,
and that's what John said. Reading with empathy can help a lot. So trying to get into that world, reading the whole story and asking how each part, like maybe if there's a part that's really hard to deal with, asking how that literary or that smaller story fits into the overarching story instead of trying to just see the details of that text, which would be important. Yeah, trying to see the overarching message of the story. I think that's helpful. Recognizing that God is complex, like you said. This is a kind of more human-centered approach, but dealing with the places that our picture of God comes from. So when we come to the Bible, we have all these assumptions about what God is like from the get-go, and some of those things are healthy and some aren't. Some of us have a hard time dealing with anger or angry depictions. Maybe that's a really big one in our culture.
Yes.
So trying to figure those things out in ourself too, I think, is helpful.
That's good. In other words, go see a therapist.
Yeah, exactly.
And
I think it's a great idea.
It might help you understand some of the baggage that you're bringing to the Bible.
Exactly.
We're going to do two questions that both relate to this idea of the sins of the fathers.
Yeah.
So for context, in Exodus 34, 6 and 7, what we've been going through, the second part of that in verse 7, God is the forgiver of iniquity, but he's also the bringer of iniquity. Mm-hmm. And when he brings iniquity, it says he brings it to the third and fourth generation.
I'll just quote it real quick here.
Sure.
He keeps loyal love for thousands by forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he won't declare innocent the guilty one. He will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon their children's children to the third and the fourth generations. That's the line we're talking about.
Yeah. And we talked about this, and you brought to our attention that this isn't about punishing the next generation for something they haven't done, but it is about holding accountable every generation for the same covenant. That still spun out a few questions. And so let's listen to both of these, one's from Johnny in California and one's from Trinette in Louisiana.
Hey guys, this is John from Long Beach. I really like the discussion you guys were having about Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. And immediately it made me think of Ezekiel 18, when God talks about how the sins of the father will not be held against the son, and the sins of the son will not be held against the father. And it goes on to say other things in relationship to that. I wanted to see how you relate the passage in Ezekiel back to Exodus, and if there's any connection there. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Trinette Armstead. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. My question is, in John 9, when Jesus and the disciples encounter a man blind from birth, the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? Is this a reference to Exodus 34:7 and the idea of visiting the iniquities of the father on the son? And can this verse be traced to and be the foundation of the idea of generational curses? Love what you guys do. Thank you.
You know, what's really cool about both of these questions is that they both are people who are recognizing patterns in scripture or looking to find repetitions. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so these are both later biblical passages that address the very topic that's raised in Exodus 34:7. Gold star, double high five, Johnny and Trinette. So maybe first to summarize what we talked about, or what I remember us talking about, the three of us in our conversation, our first conversation about it, was one, Exodus 34:7, this line about God visiting the iniquities of the fathers and the children. This is not the first time that that line appears. That's actually a restatement, a second restatement of something that God said in the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And the more I've thought about that, the more I've realized how significant that is, because it's kind of like uploading again, but assuming you remember the first statement of it. So I'm just going to read it again. It's Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. But this is the first statement of this idea, and it clarifies in a big way the questions that are often raised of the restatement in Exodus 34:7. So he's saying, don't make any idols. This is verse 4 of Exodus 20. Verse 5, don't worship those idols or serve them. I, Yahweh your God, am a passionate God. Visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing loyal love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commands. So just the main difference, you can hear the difference, is that what it's saying is that these third and fourth generations, it's talking about a generation where every generation is perpetuating the idolatry of their ancestors. And contrast, the thousands of generations are the enduring generations of which everyone loves me and keeps my commands. In other words, your summary, what you just said a moment ago, John, isn't just our interpretation just because we think that that's the right thing to say. It is actually what
preloaded
these
in the
statements mean the first time they appear.
Yeah.
So that's the first statement to make.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a reality that if all somebody knows is the wording of these from Exodus 34, I think you're going to miss an important part of what's being said here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that clarifies a lot, because you're saying that actually it's defined right here in the text that God's response is based on that person or that individual or that individual generation's sin. It's not something that he's holding against future generations.
Correct.
Yep. And the third and fourth is interesting. you know, we talked about the comparison between a little number of holding accountable mm-hmm. for each generation that repeats the sin. Stated in the Ten Commandments as hating God. Mm-hmm. And then thousands being mm-hmm. the comparison.
Yeah.
You also told us how third and the fourth is a Hebrew idiom.
Yes.
Meaning however many needed.
Yep.
And that was really interesting.
Yep.
And then you also mentioned that third and fourth has another kind of embedded meaning.
Yes.
By the time you get here.
Totally. Yes. And actually, I've now, since we've had our conversation, whenever that was, back in April
or something. Yeah.
I've thought about this more, and I think it's actually really, really significant. This is found in the second book of the Torah, Exodus, which means, in theory, you've already read, if you're the ideal Psalm 1 meditator, you're reading through the Tanakh multiple times over your life, you've already encountered the book of Genesis, the Genesis scroll. Exodus being the second. And this multi-generational repetition of the sins of the ancestors is what the whole book of Genesis is about, especially recounting three, even four generations. Mm. But for example, we've talked about this before, the way that the Cain and Abel story, the decision before Cain, the wording of that story is all picking up.
Which is the second generation of humanity.
The second generation is all picking up language of Adam and Eve's temptation and failure in Genesis 3.
Mm-hmm. So they repeat the sins of their father.
Yes. He's repeating the sins of his ancestors, even though he's not eating from a tree, he's killing his brother.
Yeah.
But it's the narrative about Cain is worded in a way to show that it's a repetition. Mm-hmm. And then Cain has multiple generations of sons, and then he has a son who's the seventh generation from Adam, a guy named Lamech, and he is 10 times worse of a murderer than his ancestor Cain. Mm-hmm. And so the Genesis narrative is already telling you that humans are actually pretty predictable in how they fail.
Yeah.
That's one. And then you actually, the main drama of Genesis is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his 12 sons.
Yeah. So Abraham and his three generations after him.
Exactly. For three, even for four. And it's the fourth generation. So Abraham gives his wife away 2 times to save his neck. There's a narrative about Isaac doing the same thing. Mm. Jacob deceives his brother and father with this deceptive cloak from the skin of a goat. Mm-hmm. And he makes a fake meal and brings it to his dad. Jacob's sons deceive him by selling their brother as a slave and bringing a deceptive cloak dipped in the blood of a goat to deceive their father. About his favorite son being dead. So the whole point is that Genesis is actually, I think it's saying both things. The message of Genesis and the message of Exodus 34:7 is saying, one, each generation is truly accountable before God for its own choices. Mm-hmm. He will deal with each generation in a just and right way. But it's also saying, the narrative argument of Genesis is saying the apple doesn't fall far. Each generation almost certainly in some way will replay or recycle some of the sins of their ancestors. And so in a way, it is what my parents' failures do in some way set me up fail in a way that's kind of similar to them, but never identical.
Yeah. So Trinette also asked about John 9, when the disciples and Jesus encounter this man who's blind from birth, and the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? So they're asking a question, assuming that sin caused this man's blindness, but they want to know if it's this person's sin or his parents' sin, which kind of relates to what we're talking about in Exodus 34. So Trinette's question is whether this verse can be traced back to Exodus 34.
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, the assumption the disciples have is if somebody is blind or in some kind of bad situation in life.
Yeah, suffering in any way.
Suffering in any way. Yeah. It's either because they wronged God or neighbor in some way or their parents did. Mm-hmm. So certainly the assumption under their question is based on the idea of children's suffering. But in this case, it would fit into that category of suffering innocently because of the sins of their ancestors. Yeah. And I think Jesus disagrees with that. Mm. He says, no, that's not
why this is
happening. Adequate explanation.
Yeah.
That also disagrees with what we are saying is one of the main points of Exodus 34:6-7.
So the disciples asking that question, where did they get that idea?
Correct.
I guess is the question I have.
Yeah, clearly it's in the air.
You know what it reminded me of is the retribution principle in Proverbs. Mm. Well, throughout other places too in the Torah, but especially in Proverbs, that if you do good, you'll be rewarded. If you are wicked, you'll be punished. Just that idea of there's a predictability to life, and this is how God acts justly, or this is wisdom. Mm. This is living wisely. Mm-hmm. And then how Job contrasts with that perspective, the book of Job, by showing that actually, like, suffering comes on people even if they are super righteous, and you can't use that principle to explain their suffering. To me, it seems like this John 9 passage is addressing that kind of idea that maybe was in the air because of even because of that sort of wisdom, which is wisdom. It's just not the only way of viewing the world.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. There may be times where, parents do something that's really, really dumb, and it sets their children up for...
Makes a lot of sense.
Totally.
Yeah, if you have parents that made some really bad mistakes, you're going to pay for it.
That's right. They will pay for it, and likely their family in the future will pay for it too. So there is an inner logic to it, but that's different than this understanding. I feel like the most frequent misunderstanding of Exodus 34:7 is innocent, like an innocent next generation.
Yeah.
That shouldn't have to be held responsible, but God's going to hold them responsible anyway.
Yeah. I'm so angry at what your parents did.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep punishing you.
Yeah. So so we're agreeing that we don't think that is a faithful or sensible understanding.
So wherever the disciples got this, it wasn't from meditating on those
Exodus
verses.
34.
Yeah. Not on that level.
Yeah.
However, what I was just trying to bring up with the multi-generational sin repetitions of the generations in Genesis is saying there are ways that the sins of parents can be experienced by their children, but it's not as if the children are innocent or exempt. They are also end up being contributors to this cascade of generational sin.
Although sometimes they don't, like in this next question from Thomas, I think he gives us a good example of a generation suffering when they are innocent because of the parents' sins.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's listen to Thomas's question and take that on board.
My name is Thomas from Auburn, Washington. When you all explained the latter half of God's announcement about himself in Exodus 34, you made it seem like God will visit the iniquity on each generation for their own sins and failures. But this has not been my experience. My biological grandfather was an alcoholic who left his family when my father was very young. The ripple effects of his sins have been felt by my father, my siblings and I, and by my own children. This is how I've always understood these verses. My sin will bring suffering to those who come after me. Is there anything to this concept, or am I just way off?
Yeah, and thank you for sharing, Thomas. What a vivid personal example. I think clearly your own experience bears out a really common pattern in human families about later generations suffering. I think what we're after is not just the suffering or pain that grandchildren might experience, for example, for something their grandfather did, but Exodus 34:7 is talking about God's role in that process.
Will he visit the iniquity?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I think it clearly is true in human experience, and it's what the biblical narratives are trying to show by so many narratives where following generations repeat the sins of their ancestors. And in a way, that's also saying that they are suffering from the sins of their ancestors if they repeat them.
Yeah.
That's a part of suffering.
It's easier to repeat
the
sins of your fathers than other sins.
Totally. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's how you learn how to live in the world from your parents and what love is like, what family relationships are like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe one challenge here is that there's a really complex reality in human experience about the history of families and the ricochet of act and consequence, the chain of act and consequence throughout multiple generations. And so that's such a complex reality. And naturally, the biblical story speaks to that. What's highlighted in Exodus 34:6-7 is about what is God's role? Or how does God work with all of that?
Mm-hmm. Especially in light of him wanting to have a covenant relationship with humanity.
Correct. That's right. And so the idea is that God will be just in how he treats every generation. Though when multiple generations keep repeating, then I think that's part of what's reflected in this phrase, visiting the iniquity. And remember, we actually have a video on the word iniquity.
Yeah.
But the word iniquity in Hebrew can refer to both the act of failure and the consequence.
Yeah.
It really isn't true in English.
It's not true in English.
What's the significance of that? It's that this is a very logical consequence for an action. So like somebody commits avon, iniquity, and then iniquity, their iniquity is just visited back on them. Kind of like if I tell Serena, my daughter, hey, if you climb up that thing, you could fall and get hurt. And then she does. And then she gets hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Her iniquity is being visited upon her.
Yeah.
In that moment. In that fall.
Yeah.
The act has created its own consequence. And the word, Hebrew word iniquity or avon accounts for both of those. Yeah, I just keep thinking the way that the Joseph story, the story of Joseph and his brothers, culminates, actually, Abraham sins, Isaac sins, and Jacob sins. Mm-hmm. It's making this point.
Three generations. We get to the fourth.
They get to the fourth, and it's like an explosion of all of the sins of the ancestors in one generation.
Mm.
But it ends with God using the brothers' evil.
Mm-hmm.
That's the culminating line of Genesis. Mm. Y'all, Joseph speaking to his brothers, y'all planned evil, Ra. Yeah. And in response to your planning evil, God planned Tov. He planned good. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that the brothers are innocent. It's not as if, oh, God hijacked my brain and made me sin. And so the book of Genesis is very much exploring as its main point the same thing that these verses are about.
Yeah, it's interesting. This third and fourth generation as it pertains to Genesis, as a commentary on Genesis, makes that fourth generation idea pop even more in that God could have just continued to be like, if you guys are going to keep going this way, it's just going to get gnarlier and gnarlier for you.
Yeah.
But on that fourth generation, what this accumulation of raw, God turns into something good.
Mm-hmm.
So as a commentary on that, it's kind of beautiful to see God saying, I'm going to hold you accountable to the third and even the fourth. But for those who turn, to me, there's thousands of generations. Like, I don't have a limit there.
Yeah, that's right.
It's almost putting a limiter a little bit on his own sense of, like, how long am I going to let this go on before I intervene?
Yeah, and key to the Genesis story is that Joseph is the most consistently righteous person in the whole book.
Oh, okay.
You know, he seems to be a little bit of a punk when he has his dreams.
When he's a kid.
But after that, he's consistently does right by God and others. And God honors that by elevating him to become, and he's a part, the way who Joseph is, how his story fits into the messianic strategy of the book of Genesis, which is to say, if humanity has a righteous representative, a Joseph-like figure, then all of a sudden the chain of cycling generational sin can be reversed and redeemed.
Yeah.
So these verses in Exodus 3-4 also aren't the final word. They're a part of creating the narrative tension that keeps driving you forward to look for the Messiah and to look for that righteous representative who will love God and keep his commandments.
Yeah.
To summarize this question about the sin of a father affecting the children and their children, what it seems like the biblical story is saying is that God is not the one who punishes. God doesn't bring punishment on children for the father's sins, but that certainly children experience the consequences of the actions of their family.
Yes.
And we see that in our world easily, you know, when there's a family member that's addicted or abusive or anything like that, it affects the children and their children ongoing. But what we're saying is that we don't see that in the text as God's punishment.
Correct.
That it's a consequence and that God wants people to find refuge in him and turn to him in that.
Yeah. I think it would be off track. And some traditions in the Christian tradition have gone this direction, talk about generational curses.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is equate that generational repetition of suffering with God's judgment as though it's a curse of sorts. And it certainly is the natural outworking of God handing a family over to the consequences of its decisions. But that doesn't, I just think calling it the generational curse, we're not using the language of the Bible at that point. We're creating some new concept that I don't think is helpful, because God's response to any of these generations is to want to redeem it based on the behavior and choices of that generation.
Mm.
And so,
and not this sense of, you guys are screwed already.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Your parents. Yeah.
Yep. Your parents determined.
Yeah.
I know this has been a long discussion, but this is the complex set of verses. Yeah. In the earlier question, Johnny brought up Ezekiel chapter 18.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about it, but it actually is a super important commentary on this whole theme in the Bible. I just noticed something really cool
that I think
will help us. Okay. So Ezekiel 18 fits into a whole section of Ezekiel that we don't have time to talk about. It's an oracle that begins by God bringing up to Ezekiel this saying. He calls it, it's a proverb, a little analogy that's floating around Israel. The saying, or the proverb, is the fathers eat sour grapes, but the children's teeth are, and there's different translations, are set on edge or are dulled or blunted. Have you ever
eaten, I don't even know what that means.
Have you ever eaten something that's super starchy and it makes your teeth feel sticky, like they're grinding on each other?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Okay.
It's a horrible feeling to imagine. It's like nails on a chalkboard, but it's your teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in a culture where winemaking was, you know, really common. This is a common experience people have. Ooh, bad grapes, bad wine did that thing to your teeth. So the logic of the proverb is the fathers, the parents do something, but it's the children who experience the direct consequences. And so what he goes on to say is, God goes on to say, nope, that's not how I deal with Israel.
Mm.
And this is all set in exile. This is exiles sitting in exile saying this proverb. The implication being, why am I sitting here in Babylon? Well, my parents were the idolaters. We're the righteous Daniels who just now are suffering for our parents' sin. And so God's whole response is, no, actually, I deal with each individual generation on its own. And so what he goes on to paint is a story of three generations of a righteous
grandfather,
a really violent son.
Mm-hmm. Who becomes the father.
Who becomes a father of a really righteous grandson.
So it's like the righteous no, it's unrighteous sandwich.
Totally.
With righteous bread.
Yeah, totally.
With a sour grape in the middle.
The
sour grape in the middle. So it's about the vertical. And what he goes on to say is that this vertical chain of guilt is not a thing in God's evaluation. He evaluates each generation by its own merits. And so in essence, what we're saying is, that's exactly what Exodus 34, 6 and 7 in context is, and Genesis is saying as well. But notice it's about three generations.
Mm-hmm.
What he then goes on to do is paint a story of how also there's no horizontal transfer of merit, which is really interesting. So let's say this is starting down in...
is it if the wicked man turns?
Yes.
21.
So, yep.
Yeah.
So starting in verse 21, he just talks about not even generations in terms of the life of one person. Let's say you have a really bad guy, but then he becomes a really good guy.
Mm-hmm.
God won't punish the redeemed guy for the stuff he did before. And then vice versa. Let's say you have a righteous guy who does bad, then he's not going to be vindicated before God because of the stuff he did righteous a long time ago. So it's really exploring this idea.
That's cool.
It is. And it all begins with a parable about parents failing when it comes to a vineyard.
Mm-hmm. While the children face the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Think through.
Yeah.
A parent failing in a garden vineyard with the children.
Adam and Eve, Noah.
Specifically, it's merging the Adam and Eve failure, replayed by Cain, with Noah's failure that's connected to wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then his son is the one who wrongs him, Ham.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's Ham's descendants, the Canaanites, who end up replaying the sin of Ham, but even more so.
Yeah, or Lot and his daughters.
His
daughters taking advantage of him.
Yeah. In other words, this little proverb is itself worded in such a way as to summarize all these generational failures passed on through the book of Genesis. There's a Jewish scholar who calls this theme in the Bible, he calls it the karmic ricochet.
Hmm.
Of the parents' failure in the book of Genesis. And I think that's such a good summary.
That is cool.
So
does it elevate to be a theme?
Oh.
The ricochet.
Wait, did you say cosmic or karmic?
Karmic.
He called it karmic.
That's karmic better
ricochet.
Name for a theme.
Borrowing the
karmic.
Anyway.
Yeah. You know, it's cool to think about that theme because, I mean, it's encouraging to me when I hear you talk about that because it means that at no point should I ever be thinking, I'm still being punished for something I did before, or maybe I'm experiencing this, or maybe God's upset with me for this thing that I did a long time ago. And that's the horizontal freedom from guilt that you're talking
that's
about.
Right. Yeah.
Or maybe I'm being punished for my parents' sins. Maybe God was just really upset with them. Yeah. If we ever like catch ourselves thinking that way, it's like actually that's right. That's not what.
But that's
the Bible
and
says.
Remember that's different than experiencing the consequences.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I might experience the consequences,
but it's not a form of punishment.
Yep. But it's not a form of divine punishment. At least that's what these texts all.
So
seem to be
I guess
us.
The difference there is that is all about God's disposition in those moments.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's
well
all
said.
About where God is in those moments. Is He punishing or is He saying, "Hey, I'm here in this consequence in the suffering that you're suffering."
Yeah. Suffering doesn't always equal divine punishment.
Yeah. Mm.
And prosperity doesn't always equal divine reward.
Right.
Welcome to the book of Job.
Right.
That's the whole message of the book of Job. Mm. So isn't it interesting when you just one verse raises a question that all of a sudden you realize is like one of the main themes in the whole Bible.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
I feel like this happens to us often.
Well, and it seems like at least from a couple of the questions we got that Exodus 34 has been used as a proof text to facilitate this idea that God will judge kids for the sins of their fathers. Mm-hmm. Because it is an intuitive thing. Mm-hmm. It was to the disciples.
Yeah, that's right.
When they were talking with Jesus about the blind man.
Yeah.
And it's this sense of, am I getting punished for something my dad did or his dad did? It's intuitive because we are facing the consequences.
Correct. Every generation
parents, every generation.
Yeah.
And you look at just the biblical narrative and these sins do seem to escalate from one generation to the next and repeat. Mm. But in spite of all that, what we see reading this verse in context of Ezekiel, in context of the Ten Commandments, which came just before it, is that God isn't hovering around trying to just punish people for what their parents did. He seems to be hovering around, like in Genesis 1, waiting to bring order to chaos when people turn back.
Yeah.
You know, like that's his, like, I like how you said, Carissa, his predisposition.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Well said.
We've done almost an hour, I think, but I think we have time to maybe
do one of these.
Just dip in a little bit to, there was
Moses.
Some questions around Moses as an intercessor.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a question from Chris Law. In England, talking about Moses.
Hi, Tim, John, and Carissa. This is Chris from Winchester, England. When Moses was reminding God of his character because God wanted to leave the Israelites, do you think there is any indication that this was God's plan all along, that he was playing hard to draw a response of compassion out of Moses? Maybe a test to see if Moses would consider God's character and plead for the Israelites rather than to seek his own legacy. Thank you for all you do. I love listening along with your conversations.
Thanks for listening along, Chris.
Yeah, Chris. Mm-hmm. It's an honor to have you on the journey. So what you're expressing, Chris, is what many people feel. It's out of an experience of turmoil that a lot of people have when pondering God's character and in this intercession narrative. So God says he wants to do one thing, destroy the people. And Moses steps in. We talked about his five acts of intercession. Moses lays down his own life. God says, no thanks, that won't be necessary. And then in three more times, Moses draws God back into the covenant partnership and to go along with the people. And so the question is, well, the question is, how seriously do I take God's words and purposes that seem to turn a corner precisely because of Moses? Was this God teaching Moses something? That's what you're pondering, Chris. Or is there a different way to think about this altogether? And really, this raises the ultimate questions about the divine purpose, God's eternal purpose in relation to finite humans and their purposes.
And how God relates to humans.
Yeah.
And also, more broadly, what the purpose of this story is.
Yep,
in
that's
its,
right.
In its spot.
Yeah,
so
that's
is
right.
it is the purpose of the story to show an example of testing? It could be multi-purposed.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Or is it something else?
Yeah. Certainly, this is a development in Moses' character in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm.
That he will intercede on behalf of rebellious people, even laying down his own life for people who don't deserve it. So certainly, it's a story about exalting Moses in this moment.
Yeah.
As being a righteous example.
Which is what we've been looking for, is this righteous intercessor.
That's totally right. However, whether God's ultimate purpose was to prove Moses' character, I have a harder time getting there.
Hmm.
Not that you are there, Chris. Seems like you're just pondering it as a possible explanation. Ask me in 2 years. I might have a different way of thinking about it. At this moment, I would reframe it and say it's less about God teaching Moses something, and it's more about the narrator trying to teach the reader something about how God relates to people.
Mm.
Namely, that God truly wants to partner with humans, and that God has made his own purpose vulnerable to human action. And I think that's the nature of God as revealed in this story, is that at least in interacting with creation, he self-limits to make his purposes truly relational. And that's actually dangerous, because humans in this story
are It's dangerous for God.
Yeah.
Well, it's dangerous for humans.
Or both.
Or both. I don't know if it's dangerous for God.
Or for his purposes.
It's certainly God makes his own purpose vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it makes humans extremely vulnerable because we keep failing. And it puts us in danger. But that's the whole point of this narrative, I think, is to drive that point home about the need for the ultimate righteous intercessor. And I think that's ultimately one of the main themes of this narrative.
What is it communicating to the reader?
What is it communicating to the reader as opposed to what is God?
What was God doing with Moses?
Moses.
Well, if you were going to think about Moses and God, and you kind of, it's almost like game theory a little bit in that, trying to see what God's motives were at that moment. Because if it was just simply a test, like then in a way, Moses is calling God's bluff because God wasn't, you know, going to walk away from his covenant in the first place.
On that interpretation.
On that interpretation.
Correct. Yeah.
And so I think there's a maybe a sense of wanting to smooth out the narrative a little bit by kind of saying, well, maybe it was just a test. What I hear you saying is we can't really go and infer that, or you don't feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
But what we can do is sit in the logic of the whole narrative getting to this point and God's kind of this relentless pursuit of partnering with humanity and then letting this moment speak to us and let us know how in this with us God is, that he would be influenced by Moses.
Yeah. And again, I think this is part of what it means to read the Hebrew Bible the way Jesus read it, as messianic wisdom literature. These stories are trying to show the need for someone to come and do the thing that no one in this story seems to be able to do.
But that Moses does really well at this moment.
Exactly. But then even he fails eventually creating the need for someone someone later. And so while it is telling me about God's relationship to humans in general, it's actually even more specifically painting a story about the divine human relationship that creates a problem that has to get solved and that Jesus claimed to be resolving himself. So when I read this story as a follower of that Jesus, I think what I ought to be doing is saying, I am so glad Jesus is interceding for me right now in this moment, and that God has met the need of that human partner by becoming that human partner in the person of Jesus. I mean, I think that's where a Christian's imagination is supposed to go in reading this story.
Yeah.
Because Jesus is
the
human.
Great high priest.
Who's
interceding on our behalf.
Interceded and has been for 2,000 years now. At least I think that's part of what it means to be a Christian, is to believe that.
To believe that. That Jesus stands in this position, like Moses was, of saying, take my life instead and be true to your commitment.
Yeah. I think where this story has ongoing truths to teach me, it's about how God truly honors the decisions and intercession and prayers of his own people. Because if I am a Christian, at least my own prayer life, it's one of the most difficult parts of being a Christian for me, is understanding prayer. But stories like this, I think, are actually meant to really bolster our confidence and boldness to say that we are invited, like Moses, to, and because of Jesus, to come before God and intercede, but not always knowing or being guaranteed of what those results might be.
So when we come to the story, we're asking the question what the purpose of the story is.
Yeah.
One of the purposes is to show what God is like, that he's responsive to humans and that he partners with humans, that he invites humans to intercede. Mm. And the story also is purposed toward foreshadowing this future person who will be an intercessor for the many. So the one righteous person who intercedes for the many. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a twofold purpose. Mm. And back to that question of whether God is genuine in this moment or not, it seems in the narrative that he's portrayed as really hurt, really upset. And like his emotions are described in a way that seems like he's being portrayed as genuine in his response. And it's a true intercessory act of Moses that changes his mind.
Yeah. And so to take this up into a whole biblical theology then is to say that same tension of justice and intercession towards mercy is a conversation happening within God's own self. Like, this is what it means to believe that Jesus is God become human, to be that intercessor, to say within the community that is God's own self, there's that same dialogue taking place even right now, I think.
It's complex.
Yeah.
God's complex.
Totally. Yeah, at least seems so to me. Who am I? But dust and ashes, as Abraham would say. There you go. Well, we just didn't wrap any of those up nicely, did we? But that was a great summary. Krista, that was like, you could have said that at the beginning.
It took me a while to reflect.
We could have left it there. So,
well, yeah, thank you for all your questions and wrestling along with us as we think through this. We're going to continue this dialogue about the attributes of God. And actually next is diving in deep into God's anger.
Yep.
And that he is slow to anger. But what does that mean to be slow to anger? And why does God of the universe get angry in the first place? And we're diving in deep with that for the next few weeks.
Yeah. I think it ended up being our most thorough treatment of both divine anger, but also divine judgment and even stories about divine violence.
Which is good because I think a lot of these questions that have come up already touch on that idea of anger.
Yep.
Judgment, maybe even changing one's mind.
Yeah, so we're going there.
We're going there.
Yep.
And it will create more questions, but also some new thoughts.
Yeah.
And I look forward to those episodes. So thank you for being a part of this with us. Bible Project is a nonprofit. We're in Portland, Oregon. Our mission is to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. This podcast is one manifestation of that. It is edited by Dan Gummel. And the show notes are by Camden McAfee, and the theme music is by the band Tense. This is a crowdfunded project, and we're grateful for all of you who are part of it with us. So thank you.
Yep.
And we'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Jeremy.
Dude, it's gotta be coming. Sound like you're about to read like a sleeping meditation.
Sorry. All right. Gosh darn it, man.
Bring it.
Hi, this is Jeremy. I'm from Choctaw, Oklahoma. I first heard about the Bible Project from my friend Nate Meenan. I use the Bible Project pretty much for fun and to learn about God. My favorite thing about the Bible Project is... what's my favorite part about the Bible Project? I don't know, man. The logo. What is my favorite thing, though? Like, I just like it in general. Alright, my favorite thing about the Bible Project is how it pieces together the biggest themes of the Bible, and it really makes sense in my brain. We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We're a crowdfunded project by people like me. Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, and more at thebibleproject.com. Nailed it.